Pruebas de certificación 2012. Dirección General de Formación Profesional y Educación de Adultos. Consejería de Educación, Universidades y Sostenibilidad. Gobierno de Canarias. Certificado de nivel avanzado. Inglés. Convocatoria ordinaria 2012. Esta parte del examen consta de tres tareas. Escuchará cada tarea dos veces. Al principio de cada tarea, dispondrá de un minuto de silencio para leer las preguntas. Entre las dos audiciones de cada tarea y al finalizar la misma, también dispondrá de un minuto de silencio.
Task 1. You will hear five extracts from a radio program. Read the statements and choose the one that best describes each person's views on this topic. Then write the letter in the corresponding box. There are three statements you will not need. Item A is an example. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
Example. I love page three. I look at page three every time I get the paper every day. It's something that all of us builders love and we can't go without.
Extract one.
You know, many, many, many young women are getting absolutely sick and tired of this sexism. And in fact, there's a Facebook page, Turn Your Back on Page 3, set up by some brilliant young feminists, and it's already got 1,300 members, you know, in no time and with no effort. And a petition which, you know, it was only up for less than 24 hours and it had 100 signatures. So I would say, join Turn Your Back on Page 3. Tell them that we're sick of it, that we do not want to be viewed as sex objects. We want to be viewed as human beings.
Extract 2.
I don't think it's degrading as such. If a woman wants to do it, then fair enough. I mean, they're getting paid enough for it anyway. The only thing is, I don't agree with it in a mainline paper. Personally, I've got kids. If I bring the paper home, first thing I open up, they see this naked woman. So it's not very nice for the underage children.
Extract 3.
You couldn't live from a sun wage alone, really. But it's kind of being a page three girl. You, as a model, you are going to then make a career out of it. So it's then up to you to put the hard work in to do the other things to get the commercial contracts, etc.
Extract 4.
Yes, they are a little bit anachronistic and sexist, but I do think that's part of society's interchange, the way the sexes interact. I think it's very, very different to the much more serious questions of sexism. For example, do we have a female newspaper editor at the minute? I mean, Rebecca Wade is now editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
We don't. So to me, it's it's a little bit odd, but not really anything to be concerned about.
Extract 5.
I think it's degrading to women, because in like the 21st century you can't have topless women in a newspaper. I think it's really like bad, but though men have something to do with it, I think women, they also say yes to it, and that it's like their choice, but I think it's sexist and misogynist.
Now listen again.
Example.
I love page three. I look at page three every time I get the paper every day. It's something that all of us builders love and we can't go without.
Extract one.
You know, many, many, many young women are getting absolutely sick and tired of this sexism. And in fact, there's a Facebook page, Turn Your Back on Page 3, set up by some brilliant young feminists. And it's already got 1,300 members, you know, in no time and with no effort. And a petition, which, you know, it was only up for less than 24 hours and it had 100 signatures. So I would say, join Turn Your Back on Page 3. Tell them that we're sick of it, that we do not want to be viewed as sex objects. We want to be viewed as human beings.
Extract 2.
I don't think it's degrading as such. If a woman wants to do it, then fair enough. I mean, they're getting paid enough for it anyway. The only thing is, I don't agree with it in a mainline paper. Personally, I've got kids. If I bring the paper home, first thing they open up, they see this naked woman. So it's not very nice for the underage children.
Extract 3.
You couldn't live from a sun wage alone, really. But it's kind of being a page three girl. You, as a model, you are going to then make a career out of it. So it's then up to you to put the hard work in to do the other things to get the commercial contracts, etc.
Extract 4.
Yes, they are a little bit anachronistic and sexist, but I do think that's part of society's interchange, the way the sexes interact. I think it's very, very different to the much more serious questions of sexism. For example, do we have a female newspaper editor at the minute? I mean, Rebecca Wade is now editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
We don't. So to me, it's a little bit odd, but not really anything to be concerned about.
Extract 5.
I think it's degrading to women, because in like the 21st century you can't have topless women in a newspaper. I think it's really like bad, but though men have something to do with it, I think women, they also say yes to it, and it's like their choice, but I think it's sexist and misogynist.
This is the end of task 1. Task 2. You will hear 3 extracts about the mini car. Choose the most suitable answer, A, B, or C, according to what you hear, and write the corresponding letters in the white boxes provided below. Item 0 is an example. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
Extract O. Simon Garfield, why was the Mini such a revolutionary car of its time?
Well, as we heard in the advert, it was cheap, for £500. It was small, which meant it didn't consume much fuel, which at the time was very important because it was born just after the Suez crisis, and everyone thought there wouldn't be any petrol at all. And it looked terrific. It was a very beautifully designed car as well.
Extract 1.
And its engine was sideways, which is how you could get more people into it.
That's right. The designer, Alec Isagonis, he wasn't the first to actually, invent this idea, but he realised this would save a fantastic amount of space. So I think something like 20% of the car was only taken up by the important things like the engines, and the rest of it was for passengers and their bags.
He was quite a character, wasn't he, Alec Isagonis?
Yeah, no, he was an extraordinary man, really. I mean, he was clearly a brilliant designer, but he wasn't hugely well-liked. People called him Aragonis and Isagonyet, and they didn't like the fact that he would say, this is my car, you design it. And even though they found leaks in it and all sorts of things, he said, that's not my problem, it's your problem.
Extract 2.
Well, I want to bring in Ian Cummings, who's worked for many years at the Mini plant in Cowley in Oxford. I think your father worked at the plant too, didn't he, Ian?
Yes, he did. My father and my mother and my paternal grandfather worked at the Cowley car factories, as they were called then.
So what was your earliest memory of the plant?
Well, when I joined straight from school, I started in what was called the body plant. It was the old Prestill Fisher plant. And when I walked in there on the first day of my commercial apprenticeship, they took me on a plant tour and I went down to A building, now known as Building 50, with the new Mini Vehicle Assembly Hall as it is. And when I walked in there, it was a huge machine shop that looked as though it was still set in the 1930s.
What did your mum say? Because your mum worked on the Mini. What did she say about her part in putting Minis together?
My mum worked in what was called the trim shop in Cowley Assembly Plant, where she was employed sewing seat covers for the Mini. But the seat covers in those days, I think, were made out of some plastic material called Rexine or something, and it was not particularly high quality and was very difficult to sew and always teared. The car was built with cost in mind and not always the best components.
I saw the very first Mini to roll off the Cowley Oxford production line last night, and it's an extraordinary simple car. There were two little switches, there was no heater, there was no radio, the original had no seat belts, so it was all, you know, it was all passenger space, not the safest of cars to drive, of course. And I had a look under the hood, and it looked as if, you know, I'm not a technical person at all, but it looked like the sort of car that even I could actually fix.
Extract 3.
Did it become an overnight success, or was there a need for clever marketing along the way to turn it into the icon that it is today?
It took a long while. I mean, we heard the adverts there, and they knew that they had something that was a unique car. They had no idea that it would obviously last 50 years. But it took 3 or 4 years for people to get used to it. And Isagonis was very, very smart. The designer thought, well, it interests the royal family in this. So if it's good enough for them, it's going to be good enough for anyone else. So that's what he did. He drove the Queen around Windsor, and Lord Snowden became very, very interested and a great champion. And then what happened in the mid-60s, it became a real icon of swinging 60s.
Peter Sellers had one, didn't he? And lots of film stars took
them
up.
Exactly, and the Beatles. As well, and Twiggy.
Now listen again.
Extract O.
Simon Garfield, why was the Mini such a revolutionary car of its time?
Well, as we heard in the advert, it was cheap, for £500. It was small, which meant it didn't consume much fuel, which at the time was very important because it was born just after the Suez crisis, and everyone thought there wouldn't be any petrol at all. And it looked terrific. It was a very beautifully designed car as well.
Extract 1.
And its engine was sideways, which is how you could get more people into it.
That's right. The designer, Alec Issagonis, he wasn't the first to actually, invent this idea, but he realised this would save a fantastic amount of space. So I think something like 20% of the car was only taken up by the important things like the engines, and the rest of it was for passengers and their bags.
He was quite a character, wasn't he, Alec Issagonis?
Yeah, no, he was an extraordinary man, really. I mean, he was clearly a brilliant designer, but he wasn't hugely well-liked. People called him Aragonis and Issagonis, and they didn't like the fact that he would say, this is my car, you design it. And even though they found leaks in it and all sorts of things, he said, that's not my problem, it's your problem.
Extract 2.
Well, I want to bring in Ian Cummings, who's worked for many years at the Mini plant in Cowley in Oxford. I think your father worked at the plant too, didn't he, Ian?
Yes, he did. My father and my mother and my paternal grandfather worked at the Cowley car factories, as they were called then.
So what was your earliest memory of the plant?
Well, when I joined straight from school, I started in what was called the body plant. It was the old Prestill Fisher plant. And when I walked in there on the first day of my commercial apprenticeship, they took me on a plant tour and I went down to A building, now known as Building 50, with the new Mini Vehicle Assembly Hall as it is. And when I walked in there, it was a huge machine shop that looked as though it was still set in the 1930s.
What did your mum say? Because your mum worked on the Mini. What did she say about her part in putting Minis together?
My mum worked in what was called the trim shop in Cowley Assembly Plant, where she was employed sewing seat covers for the Mini. But the seat covers in those days, I think, were made out of some plastic material called Rexine or something, and it was not particularly high quality and was very difficult to sew and always teared. The car was built with cost in mind and not always the best components.
I saw the very first Mini to roll off the Cowley Oxford production line last night, and it's an extraordinary simple car. There were two little switches, there was no heater, there was no radio, the original had no seat belts, so it was all, it was all passenger space, not the safest of cars to drive, of course. And I had a look under the hood, and it looked as if, I'm not a technical person at all, but it looked like the sort of car that even I could actually fix.
Extract 3.
Did it become an overnight success, or was there a need for clever marketing along the way to turn it into the icon that it is today?
It took a long while. I mean, we heard the adverts there, and they knew that they had something that was a unique car. They had no idea that it would obviously last 50 years. But it took 3 or 4 years for people to get used to it. And Issagonis was very, very smart. The designer thought, well, it interests the royal family in this. So if it's good enough for them, it's going to be good enough for anyone else. So that's what he did. He drove the Queen around Windsor, and Lord Snowden became very, very interested and a great champion. And then what happened in the mid-60s, it became a real icon of swinging 60s.
Peter Sellers had one, didn't he? And lots of film stars took them up.
Exactly, and the Beatles as well, and Twiggy.
This is the end of Task 2. Task 3. Listen to the following documentary about a game. Write the missing words according to what you hear, maximum of 2 words per blank. Sentence 0 is given as an example. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
Louise Hidalgo takes us back to the early days of the gaming revolution and something called Pong.
The year is 1972, and from a garage in California, the video game that is to launch a multi-billion dollar industry is about to be unveiled to the world.
In fact, it was meant as a training project for one of my engineers, and we kept fiddling with it and doing slight improvements, and one of the improvements all of a sudden made the game completely fun. And we said, gee, maybe we've got something here.
The game was Pong, basically a simplified video version of table tennis. Nolan Bushnell persuaded a bar, Andy Capps, in Sunnyvale, California, to install Pong as an arcade video game. And that's when he and his co-founder realized that they could be onto something big. What was the point when you realized that this was going to be much bigger than you'd ever imagined?
The day we opened the cash box, and it was completely full. In a coin-operated game, you can almost predict the success of it 100% based on how much money people will put into it. And in those days, sort of the gold standard was if it could do $20 a day, it made a lot of money. And the Pong game was earning $35 and $40, maybe even $50 a day on some days. And so that was so far above the gold standard that we knew we had a success.
2 years later, Atari developed a home version of Pong that could be plugged into the back of a TV. It was the beginning of a gaming revolution. By 1975, Pong was one of the most sought-after presents for Christmas, and its appeal had even crossed the Atlantic. What was it, do you think, that made Pong so successful?
I think there were two or three things. I think it was a happy accident in space and time. The game was one which used small muscle coordination, you know, turning of a knob. And the average woman could beat the average man playing Pong. And in bars, there started to be kind of this whole sociology built up around the game, in which it was okay for a woman to challenge a guy off one of the bar stools to come and play Pong. Second, there was something mesmerizing about the game. Once you played and won or lost, you almost had to play again. And then probably the third thing is that people had never seen anything that they could play that was that crisp and that controllable and that understandable. And I think that it was vaguely satisfying to them.
By this time, Nolan had moved Atari out of the garage unit into an old converted roller skating rink, where they tried to keep up with the demand for Pong. And, excuse me for asking, but how old were you at that stage?
It's 28. All the executives of the company were in their late 20s. Most of the employees were in their early 20s. And it was not common to have that happen. Today, you know, I feel like I kind of paved the way for Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Michael Dell. All these guys came after me, but I know of no 20-something CEO of a major electronics company before me. It was kind of interesting times.
And what did your mum think?
Well, when I started this, I can remember her saying, "Oh, Nolan, but you had such a good job." Of course, moms are always about risk, and she thought that I was quitting a good job for a really risky enterprise. Later on, she thought that it was really cool.
Nolan Bushnell is today seen as one of the founding fathers of the video game industry. The magazine Newsweek named him as one of the 50 men who changed America. Pong became so popular in the 70s, it was said to have caused a coin shortage in America of the quarters needed to play. And since then, the video game industry has gone from strength to strength, and last year it was worth $40 billion.
Now listen again.
Luis Hidalgo takes us back to the early days of the gaming revolution and something called Pong.
The year is 1972, and from a garage in California, the video game that is to launch a multi-billion dollar industry is about to be unveiled to the world.
In fact, it was meant as a training project for one of my engineers. And we kept fiddling with it and doing slight improvements. And one of the improvements all of a sudden made the game completely fun. And we said, gee, maybe we've got something here.
The game was Pong, basically a simplified video version of table tennis. Nolan Bushnell persuaded a bar, Andy Capps, in Sunnyvale, California, to install Pong as an arcade video game. And that's when he and his co-founder realized that they could be onto something big. What was the point when you realized that this was going to be much bigger than you'd ever imagined?
The day we opened the cash box, and it was completely full. In a coin-operated game, you can almost predict the success of it 100% based on how much money people will put into it. And in those days, sort of the gold standard was if it could do $20 a day, it made a lot of money. And the Pong game was earning $35 and $40, maybe even $50 a day on some days. And so that was so far above the gold standard that we knew we had a success.
2 years later, Atari developed a home version of Pong that could be plugged into the back of a TV. It was the beginning of a gaming revolution. By 1975, Pong was one of the most sought-after presents for Christmas, and its appeal had even crossed the Atlantic. What was it, do you think, that made Pong so successful?
I think there were two or three things. I think it was a happy accident in space and time. The game was one which used small muscle coordination, you know, turning of a knob, and the average woman could beat the average man playing Pong. And in bars, there started to be kind of this whole sociology built up around the game in which it was okay for a woman to challenge a guy off one of the bar stools to come and play Pong. Second, there was something mesmerizing about the game. Once you played and won or lost, you almost had to play again. And then probably the third thing is that people had never seen anything that they could play that was that crisp and that controllable and that understandable. and I think that it was vaguely satisfying to them.
By this time, Nolan had moved Atari out of the garage unit into an old converted roller skating rink, where they tried to keep up with the demand for Pong. And, excuse me for asking, but how old were you at that stage?
It's 28. All the executives of the company were in their late 20s. Most of the employees were in their early 20s. And it was not common to have that happen. Today, you know, I feel like I kind of paved the way for Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Michael Dell. All these guys came after me, but I know of no 20-something CEO of a major electronics company before me. It was kind of interesting times.
And what did your mom think?
Well, when I started this, I can remember her saying, "Oh, Nolan, but you had such a good job." Of course, moms are always about risk, and she thought that I was quitting a good job for a really risky enterprise. Later on, she thought that it was really cool.
Nolan Bushnell is today seen as one of the founding fathers of the video game industry. The magazine Newsweek named him as one of the 50 men who changed America. Pong became so popular in the 70s, it was said to have caused a coin shortage in America of the quarters needed to play. And since then, the video game industry has gone from strength to strength, and last year it was worth $40 billion.
This is the end of Task 3.